This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Howdy, it's the Texas edition of Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, political science professor from Texas Southern University in the home of the world champion Houston Astros.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Jay, we are currently looking out the window of the Houston Public Media Studios, and we see Minute Maid Park, and we are basking in the glory that is the Houston Astros and their world championship, right?
That's right. The Astros are World Series champs. It's literally brought baseball back here in Houston and in Texas, and one of the highest rated World Series ever. It's become a national sport again, all thanks to the Houston Astros.
We've done it, right? Astros can solve anything, right? Well, one thing it also solved was I think it gave the city a kind of sense of resolve as well as a kind of common way to be able to overcome some of the tragedies that occurred during Harvey. So to me, this is a nice way to put a cap on some of the great unity that the city has felt post-Harvey. But this feels much sweeter. Speaking of Harvey, we have the state asking the federal government for a big chunk of money. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Governor Abbott has been pressing ahead and I think has been pretty successful in getting additional dollars, about some $61 billion that he's been seeking for aid for Texas. He has been working sort of the appropriations process to get that amount sort of committed. I think the governor is arguing now that, look, this may not come in one chunk, but the delegation needs to be strong and united and continue to press forward.
You know what struck me is that some 60% of the funding goes to future-proofing, flood-proof areas. So they're really taking a proactive view of this. And of course, some of this, about 33%, are for buyouts and for elevating buildings in low-lying areas. So it's definitely the case that they are trying to recover and replace what happened, but also thinking ahead, which is really good. But my fear here is that polarization and partisan gridlock we find in Washington is going to affect the ability to get this done. Congress has to pass a budget to be able to put this in the budget. A big number, right? Like you said, $61 billion. If they only get the money from a continuing resolution, then it's not going to be the same. And Texas really needs this money.
This is where we were talking about on the national show was the issue of the tax reform that they're trying to do, which sort of fits all in together. And so the big question is, will they have enough in terms of budget flexibility to have these kind of projects funded? And is this sort of a larger sort of sign moving forward that the national budgetary process may go back to kind of this earmarked process? Something we just haven't seen in a while. Speaking of the governor, there's also been, you know, the governor's weighed in on a pretty contentious issue here in Texas, and that's sort of Confederate monuments, Confederate statues. But there's an odd Confederate plaque that exists on the state capitol. What exactly happened to Brandon? What's the governor saying about it?
This is a plaque which is from the Children of the Confederacy that vows to preserve the, quote, pure ideals and, quote, to teach the truths of history. And it adds that the war between the states was not a rebellion and was not necessarily done to sustain slavery. Obviously, there's some inaccuracies here, and the governor has acknowledged that. What he said this week was that this is something which is substantially inaccurate from a historical statement. So we know that perhaps the governor politically doesn't want to weigh in on this, but in terms of the weight of history here, it seems like they may have some movement to remove this and put it someplace else.
I think it's fair to say as a general rule that historical markers, historical monuments, they just shouldn't lie. And essentially what this plaque does is lie, right? Because we know that is what it said is not accurate,
right?
And the other portion of it is that the reason why the plaque exists was put in at a time to essentially rewrite the reality of the Civil War, which, you know, was by all accounts, historical accounts, slavery was the most significant component of it, or the eradication of slavery, the attempted eradication. And so that's really what the Civil War is about. That's what this plaque essentially tried to lie about. And so kudos for the governor for, I think, doing that when, as you said, there are individuals sort of in his political base that really feel like if it's up and it's old, it should stay up regardless of the content. And I think this speaks a lot to Governor Abbott's desire to want to try to bring the state together in a positive way.
Yeah, he's defusing the situation. That's something that we haven't seen a lot of in politics. Typically, ramping up is, especially in an election year, more the norm. So I think this might be a signal that the governor is willing to be centrist on some things and to be able to play ball on others.
I think that's also the confidence of being the most popular elected official in the state.
Yeah.
You get to do those kinds of things every now and then.
You've got a little capital, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of additional diffusing of controversy, it turns out that the Kaufman County District Attorney, who we had mentioned last week, who had opened a bribery investigation into Attorney General Ken Paxton's accepting of some money for his legal defense fund, has been closed. So tell us a little bit about that.
A criminal case that was opened up related to some investments before he even became Attorney General. Subsequent to that, he then created a legal defense fund. And subsequent to that, there was a $100,000 contribution made into this legal defense fund. And that fund, the person who made that turned out to have a subsequent case that the attorney general was involved in. All of this was done sort of at an arm's length, and it appeared that there was some obvious conflict at play here. It was then investigated, and the Kaufman County DA said, no, there's been no real violation of state law. There's no indication there was anything wrong here, so we're going to close this investigation up. So for now, Attorney General Paxton's in the clear when it comes to his defense fund, but the underlying case is still alive.
You know, the Attorney General's really, I think, dodged a bunch of bullets on these various issues, right? I think that legally he has been able to be able to get through this. So we'll see what happens, of course, when we move through. But this is definitely the case that, as most elected officials, especially in Texas, they're able to survive these kinds of scandals. So this is another one of those examples.
I'm more surprised that he still hasn't had any real challengers, both within the party and on the Democratic side. It hasn't hurt him politically. His wife is now the leading candidate,
right,
for a state Senate seat. And so it's just the whole thing is a little bit interesting, just from the odd politics of it. He hasn't missed a beat.
Yeah.
It hasn't been a hiccup for him at all.
You're not worried about your brand if your wife is running for a different office, right? Vincent Harding, who is the chair of the Travis County Democratic Party, apparently has expressed some interest in running for AG. So there may be a couple of challengers, but we're getting really close to that deadline, Jay, right? November 11th, I think, is the deadline,
yeah,
for somebody to file paperwork to run in the primary. So it's really closing in terms of time.
Well, Brandon, as any good Texan, you must be a fan of the pecan pie.
Pecan pie.
Pecan
pie. Is that why you're asking?
Yeah, I've got some right here. Well, you know who really likes pecans? Our U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. There's been an interesting sort of brouhaha where he has become this strong fighting advocate for the plight of the pecan. Well, tell us about it.
Well, so this is interesting. It turns out that that there are pecan tariffs in some countries, especially with India, that are hurting the industry. And Ted Cruz has begun talks to try to eliminate these. So it's an interesting kind of nutty arrangement. I'm sorry. I was up late watching the Astros. So
yeah. No,
my
but
puns,
I mean,
are bad.
But you know what? I will say this. I think that's great that Ted Cruz wants to sort of do this. It's interesting. Cruz has been a free trader for a long time and I think really wants to see more trade going on. So I think this is a positive thing. It's great for the state, obviously, since Texas is really the big producer of pecans globally. The other part of it is, you know, in conjunction in that same sort of speech he was talking about, he made, a really robust defense of NAFTA.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing sort of old school Ted Cruz. He's back.
Interesting. He's back.
He's back.
And nuttier than ever, right?
Yeah. So Ted's fighting the fight for pecans and free trade and trying to, create a little distance for him on what he's about and versus what Trump's about.
I think that last statement is exactly right. He is running for re-election. So clearly he's going to try to find a way to be able to connect the Texans. The book on Ted Cruz is that he wants to run for president, and that's the thing that he cares about more than being the senator from Texas. This shows that he can really pull in some of these issues and be for Texas. And that's something I think that especially in election year he needs to do.
Brandon, did you know we have an election next week?
An election? Interesting.
In fact, people are voting right now. So we are going to take a little break, come back, and talk about what's on the state ballot.
Well, Well, Jay, like you said before the break, we've got voting going on, so although we don't tend to have a lot of fanfare around it, this is an important part of what we do as Texans. So let's talk a little bit about the constitutional amendments, Jay. We've got 7 that are on the ballot, so everybody who is anywhere in the state is going to get to vote on these. What's your read on what is going to happen with these and what it means for the state?
I think by and large that the 7 constitutional amendments are relatively innocuous. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in there that should get people really riled up. There's 3, I think, that are somewhat have had some back and forth in terms of some people having some concerns.
Yeah.
The first being the issuance of home equity loans and some of the fees associated with it. You've had some consumer groups concerned that it may lead to increased costs. It essentially makes it easier to get a home equity loan. And that it also makes it easier to convert things from home equity out of home equity. Mm-hmm. Without getting people's eyes to glaze over, essentially what it's going to do is make it easier for you. So if you're concerned of people sort of getting taken advantage of, which is what the initial issue with home equity loans were, that might be a problem. But I think by and large, there's enough safeguards in there that it's not a huge issue. The second one to me is this referral process, an automatic referral to the Attorney General, extending the time period if and when there's a constitutional question raised at a state court level. So if you're at a state district court and one of the issues involves the constitutionality of an issue, there's an automatic referral to a 45-day period to get sent to the Attorney General. Some lawyers, I think, have questioned that, whether it's the appropriate thing to do. And I think that's another one where, again, I think there's issues on both sides there. But I don't think it's a particular issue that's going to cause a lot of people some heartburn. And really, the last one is this question of, what do you do with these holdover appointees? The Texas legislature only meets every other year. Sometimes terms expire. What's happened in the past is if there's not a renewal, folks just kind of stay on a board. And sometimes that can be a problem. And so this essentially says, when your term ends, your term ends. You can't continue to be a holdover indefinitely.
Yeah, I think you're right. So you're talking about first Proposition 2, which is it lowers the cap on home equity loan fees related to a particular loan, and people can refinance equity loans as refinance non-home equity loans. One worry is that it does take away some consumer protection, and so voters should know that this is on the table. Essentially, it allows for a non-home equity loan refinance to be foreclosed on without a court order, and also there will be limited recourse for personal liability against an individual and or their spouse. So there are some concerns that might be problematic that people should definitely be aware of. And I think, too, from an institutional point of view, that, like you say, Proposition 4, which is the one that allows this legislature to require the courts to inform the AG that there's a legal challenge, and it requires that there's a waiting period of not more than 45 days after a judge notifies the AG before a judge can rule on an issue. I'm a little taken aback by the fact that the legislature is attempting to tell the courts what to do. That's something I think which is troublesome. It certainly strengthens the legislature vis-a-vis the courts, and I think that's worrisome. You also mentioned Prop 3, which is that would essentially allow for gubernatorial appointees to only serve until the last day of the legislative session after their term expires. That tends to strengthen the hand of the legislature, right, at the expense of the governor. So I do think you see some kind of underlying issues with respect to how government's structured, and that's something which is really interesting. But I'm just not sure people are going to really be that attentive to those kinds of changes.
I think it's important to let everyone know, in addition to these 7, we have municipal elections going on in some cities. You've got school board elections going on. You've also got local propositions in various parts of Texas. Here in Houston, home of the world champion Houston Astros.
You don't say.
I know. I don't know if you've heard that.
How many times we have to get that in mind?
I know. You got to get it out. But we've got some really, I think, really important propositions, A through F here. In particular, pension bonds, issuance of pension bonds. This was a big issue in the last legislative session. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner has made this the centerpiece of his fiscal agenda, sort of reforming pension systems. You've got to have this. It's got to work. And it is an important part of it. And I think it's got a lot of bipartisan support. Proposition A is a good piece of legislation, if it's the way to describe it that way. It's really the issuance of debt that we already owe. But we should tell people there's a lot of school board elections out here in Houston and in the surrounding area and in around Texas. Just want to get everyone out there voting.
Voting is critical. And like you say, this is something that is important for the city of Houston, but also for the state, right? Because there are major pension problems all across the state. And this $1 billion pension bond that the mayor has backed, and frankly, also that much of the Houston business community, as well as many of the Republicans have backed, is something that's critical to that. So this is like the mayor's ring, right? In the quest for the ring, the Lord of the Rings, right? And so this is definitely a critical component of that. And the public needs to be aware that it's important to go out and express your opinion, right? Whether you vote yes or no. That's, I think, a foundational part of how the city will be righted financially.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to tell you what we're going to do on these constitutional amendments and these votes.
So, Jay, we talked about all these propositions on the ballot statewide. We talked about some of the specific propositions in Houston. So, okay, number one, what do you think is going to happen with respect to the passage of these? And number two, how many people do you think are going to come vote?
Two great questions. Well, I think they'll all pass. The statewide constitutional amendments will all pass.
They almost always do, right?
Yeah, they almost always do. And I think they'll probably pass pretty overwhelmingly. There's very little opposition to any of them, at least on a formalized basis. I think here in Houston, Proposition A, sort of that signature piece that the Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner has put out is going to pass. And I think most of the bonds should pass. I think it's a little bit hard to tell, and we'll talk about that because of turnouts. But I think that's the case. We're going to probably see probably around 7.5% to 8% turnout, which is just very, very small.
Yeah.
And so I think that's going to be the big issue. Anytime you have elections that are this small, it has a huge impact.
It's hard for people to connect to these constitutional issues, right, because it's absent personality and party, and they are obscure, they are oddly written, right? They're very legalistic, and so it's really difficult to be able to kind of parse exactly what it means and understand the context of it. So I'm not surprised people don't come to vote for these things, especially because also it's on an off-year election, right? It's 2017, and everybody's already still happy about the Astros. But hey, if we could link those things together, that'd be great, right? Astros pride, city pride, you know, come back and vote and help the city to struggle away from this embarrassing low turnout, right? But you're exactly right. This is critical for the state. This is really the framers of the Texas Constitution's connection to people, right? They wanted the voters to have a say in how this process went. And this is our way to be able to connect to government. So if people complain about how things are in Austin, then this is a great way for you to have your voice. And if you don't like what's happening at city council, then you can go and express your opinions here exactly the same. So it's worth going to vote. It's just a few minutes. You're probably not going to have a lot of company there, but it's really critical for the city and the state.
That's right. At least there's no lines to slow you down.
Not going
to
worry,
right?
About a lot of people.
Yeah, unlike waiting in line to purchase Astros merchandise now.
Right. Get your merchandise and then go vote.
Exactly. Well, that's a wrap for this week. Remember, we also do a weekly national politics episodes too, which you can also download on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. As always, thanks to Houston Public Media, our producer extraordinaire, Edel Howland, and thanks to our engineer, superstar, our very own Astro, Todd Hulslander.
Hey, leave us a review on iTunes because it'll help other people find the podcast. Any questions? Hey, shoot us a tweet with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod or email us at PartyPoliticsPod@HoustonPublicMedia.org.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. Go Astros, and we'll see you next week.